I don't consider myself a collector. I am an occasional habitué of flea markets and galleries and auctions and antique shows and eBay. And every now and then I do buy things, but not with any collecting strategy or conscious obsession. But then, a few years ago, I realized that as often as not, the things I covet are maps. Literal micro-scale maps, like my 1862 map of a few blocks of New York's East Village neighborhood that is overlaid with the 17th century Dutch streets running at an angle to the modern streets, and maps at the grandest scale imaginable, like my dozen antique maps of the solar system and galaxies. So maybe I am obsessed. On driving vacations, I'm the designated navigator. So sometimes, passing down an idyllic Tuscan hillside or past some exquisite Irish beach, I have to be reminded by family members to look outside instead of staring down at my beloved Michelin roadmap. Now that I think about it, what were the most exciting and memorable pages of my books as a child? Why, the map of the Hundred Acre Wood in my Winnie the Pooh hardcovers, and the map of Middle Earth in my paperback of The Hobbit, and the maps of Gettysburg and Manassas in my books about the Civil War. We inhabit a civilization where maps have always been central as artful tools, as vistas of cultural identity and ambition, as expressions of our restlessness and hankering for adventure. So today in Studio 360, we'll be talking about maps, and my special guest and guide through this terrain is Simon Schama, the historian and cultural scholar who's written several breathtaking books, including Rembrandt's Eyes, Landscape and Memory, and most recently, his History of Britain. Simon, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you, like me, have had a long interest in, if not perhaps as unhealthfully as I, in maps.
Yes, I love them as a kid, and I love them so much that I made them. I used to simply take out a sheet of white paper and start with always a kind of curvy line and then a wrinkled, indented line. That would be a coast, and then I'd produce a bay. And what kids do when they make those first maps or when they look at their first maps is make a series of stories. I did a little bay because I wanted a pirate ship to be in there. I wanted a mountain because this was one in which my my child hero, moi, was going to get to the top of and spy, you know, some sort of sneak pit or some perfect crock of gold below. And that was true, I think, when Europeans first started to do maps. They also moved from place to place, catching stories as they went, and they wanted to kind of plant something which said, this happened to me there, this happened to me here.
Well, in fact, A History of Britain, Volume 2, begins with your story of maps and a map maker.
Right. Maps seem to come before nations. There's a map maker called John Speed, who was a tailor, and one of his contemporaries said he stitched together England. He had 18 children, and he got incredibly interested in doing maps of counties. And this had been done before in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, but they were maps for gentlemen mostly. Queen Elizabeth's favorite counselor, William Cecil, Lord Burghley, had produced for him, done by a man called Christopher Saxton, the first pocket atlas, I think. I mean, he was the first politician, was Cecil, to, as it were, go on the road with the Queen and want to know, where the hell am I and who are these people? And am I still in Shropshire?
And what John Speed did is create a sort of popular...
He did it for the people, yeah. Exactly. And the odd thing was he knew that the, you know, pockets, don't want pockets. What you want is a big production number, but done quite cheaply. But it would have to have sort of little men in it. You didn't want just roads and names. When you got to Cambridge, you had to have gussied up, as we say, with pictures of bearded professors. And you needed battles. And he actually was the first person to have tiny little munchkin-like people waving lances and spears and pikes at each other planted in the place where the Wars of the Roses had happened.
So what we regard as sort of the modern tourist map mode, he was really...
Entertainment. Yeah. Armchair travel and entertainment.
So it really was about stories.
It was still about stories, yes.
Is this interest in maps and this need for maps, do you think, a peculiarly Western thing, or is it, do we just have it a sort of greater obsession with this depiction of reality than other cultures?
Well, it's a travel thing, and other cultures, like, you know, the Arabs, really, in medieval Islam, was incredibly restless, had great mariners, and in fact, we got our first sort of sailing chance, as I understand it, not being a great sailor, from the Arabs. We knew how to get from Africa to India because Vasco da Gama, Diogo, people like that, the Portuguese, pinched Arab navigators. So the Arabs at that point were very restless. But we've always been restless. I mean, our first great ripping yarn travel book is Herodotus. And Herodotus is not from Athens. He's from the islands. And that book, even though it's supposed to be about us, the Greeks and the Persians, it's fantastically footloose. It wants to know. He goes to Egypt and he goes to Persia and he wants to tell you that in Egypt, women pee standing up. Therefore, it's a very different place. But he also, by telling you about weird things that happen in Egypt and Persia, he makes them closer, not dangerously exotic. But they also have to, I think it's a thing about maps, Kurt, that actually, and with your 100-acre wood, there are maps which take you place by place and story by story, but then you want to know where the end is somehow. I mean, even if Western Lion's going to trail off into the ocean or they're going to be sort of mysterious, you want to be in literally that bird's-eyed view so you can actually have the whole world in the palm of your hand. There's something we crave to know that somehow.